ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon, Selena Green bringing you The Country Hour again today. In a moment, I'll have an update for you on what may have killed more than 100 Australian cattle on board an export ship. I'll also take a look at the level of foreign investment in Australian agriculture and what's needed to help Australian agriculture along the journey to net zero.
Something that's really going to be important as we continue to look at things like emissions reduction technologies, carbon farming, a whole range of those areas around the carbon and emission space, is that we take the time to ensure we've got trusted information sources to make sure, particularly we've got farmers making sound business decisions that's in their best interest for the long term.
That's all coming up in this half an hour. But first today, the Federal Department of Agriculture continues to investigate the deaths of more than 100 Australian cattle on board the export ship Brahman Express, which sailed to Indonesia earlier this month. It won't confirm exactly how many cattle have died. Industry groups say the cattle came from the one property in the Northern Territory and is assumed the toxin botulism caused the cattle deaths. Australia's chief vet, Beth Cookson, explains how botulism presents in livestock.
The cattle that died on board the vessel were not showing any signs that would make us suspect a disease like foot and mouth disease or lumpy skin disease. As a part of the investigation into the cause of the mortalities on the vessel, the department has been working closely with the exporter and the Northern Territory government to understand why the mortality event has occurred. That has included sending veterinary officers to the registered establishment that prepared the cattle, and it has been identified that a number of cattle has also died within that facility. So we know that the signs that are being expressed are consistent with botulism.
Yeah, the industry suggested that botulism could be the cause or was the number one suspect, I suppose. How prevalent or how common is it that you would have mortality rates on a live export ship caused by botulism?
Well, botulism is a common bacteria globally, including in Australia. It's only under very specific environmental conditions that the bacteria starts to generate a toxin that essentially when eaten or is contaminating water creates this condition in cattle. And so what we suspect has occurred is that the exposure occurred prior to export and that the cattle, when they were inspected for export, were not showing any clinical signs of disease, but that disease developed once they were on the livestock voyage.
What's the incubation period?
The incubation period can be up to 17 days after exposure. Often it's more quick than that. But what we do find is once the incubation period has completed and the animals have been infected by the toxin, that the rapid onset occurs and the animals then die quite quickly after that.
So it is fatal in cattle?
Usually it's fatal. We would say that more often than not, animals that have been infected will die of the toxin. There is no specific treatment for botulism once the animals have been exposed to the toxin. Some animals may recover through supportive therapy by making sure that they've got food and water and shade, but that's not the usual outcome.
But there is a vaccine that could potentially prevent botulism in cattle, is that right?
Yes, there is a vaccine that can be used in cattle and is commonly used in Australian cattle. That's why we don't regularly see mortalities at this scale.
And just to be clear, because I understand humans can contract a form of botulism too, but what we're talking about here in the livestock is quite a separate disease, and that if humans are handling infected livestock, it's highly unlikely that they will in fact be infected or sick. Is that right?
There are a number of different types of botulinum toxins, and people are not usually susceptible to the ones that affect cattle. What I would be saying is that meat from clinically normal animals in herds affected by a botulism outbreak is safe for human consumption.
And when will we know, when is it likely that the department will be able to confirm this suspected botulism or otherwise?
The investigation is ongoing. Botulism is usually diagnosed by veterinarians through the way that the disease is expressed, the clinical signs on the ground, as well as excluding a range of, other potential causes.
That's Australia's chief vet, Beth Cookson, speaking there to Kath Sullivan. It's 10 minutes past 12. Well, agriculture has emerged as one of the key industries of focus as Australia moves towards net zero. And while great strides have been made, still a long way to go. The challenges and opportunities for agriculture in a net zero environment were a big focus of a panel discussion at yesterday's Regions Rising event in Adelaide. It was run by the Regional Australia Institute, which also released a couple of reports looking at how regional Australia and its key industries, such as agriculture, can decarbonise. The head of Thomas Elder Sustainable Agriculture, David McEwen, was on the panel. I spoke with him about how far down the path towards net zero ag is.
We're certainly making a lot of really positive progress, but as a sector and as individual businesses, something that we're really importantly looking at when we look at this net zero transition is not to look at it in isolation of individual commercial businesses and operations and all the other factors that come into play when you're running a business and the broader agricultural sector. So one thing that we really like to ensure is that we're not getting trapped in carbon tunnel vision or a pure focus just on carbon, just on net zero emissions, because we know that if we do that purely and don't take into account a lot of other factors, that will come at the expense of a whole range of other factors, whether that's agricultural productivity and profitability on farm, whether that's biodiversity and the way we manage the landscape. So it is really important that we look at it from a whole of sustainability and business profitability perspective, but we are making really positive progress in some key areas, and we are seeing that particularly, when we look at the majority of our emissions in agriculture do come from the livestock sector, from the beef sector, and really big leaps and gains have been made there in the past few years on looking at that total net position of the sector. There's emissions reduction there, but a lot of that's been driven by individual farmers, businesses in the sector working hard to reduce emissions intensity, becoming more productive and producing more beef per unit of emissions, which brings down the total net carbon position.
Because that is one of the big challenges, I guess, for ag is to say, well, you can have a target to reach, carbon neutrality or net zero, but at the same time, you can't be reducing your output because we need producers to be producing more. You can't have it costing too much to put this into place because that's going to flow onto consumers as well. And obviously the environmental factor in there is farmers being stewards of the environment that they live and work on. These are all factors that I guess make it very complicated for agriculture to achieve that target.
Yes, absolutely. That's absolutely right. And the other overlays here that we're looking at as well is there's a whole lot of technological solutions that are coming down the pipeline. So whether we are looking at, different ways to produce fertiliser that have got a lower carbon footprint, so looking at green-based ammonias and nuclear-based fertilisers, or whether we're looking at methane inhibitors for livestock feed supplements, there's a whole lot of these things that hopefully at some point in time are technically feasible. There's a lot of research, investment happening in that space, but we are a fair way off. We're looking at decades before we actually have a clear transition pathway that's commercially viable for the sector to actually manage that transition. So while everyone's doing what they can with here and now. At a broader sector, we're looking over the horizon of what more we can do and where technology will take us. We are a fair way off still of having commercially viable pathways for farm businesses and indeed the broader agribusiness supply chain to be able to really have a clear understanding of how they could pursue and practically achieve a net zero target or ambition.
Because when we say agriculture, I mean, obviously that is a broad church. There is a lot in there, but it will be down to what you farm and where you farm will drive a lot of what really is achievable and what's going to work in terms of, offsetting your output.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Sloane. So if we think about the major agricultural production systems in South Australia, so if we look at the grain sector, we do know that about 30% of the emissions, if you look at the farm, do actually come off scope 3 emissions of the production of fertilisers. So that's well out of the control of the farmer, and the available products are starting to emerge, but we're a long way off those being viable and able for farmers to access. So there's sort of those sort of pathways if you're looking from a cropping perspective, through to if you're looking at a livestock perspective, very different again, because you're looking at your major emissions factors are largely around that methane production from ruminant livestock, so like in the beef sector or in the sheep sector. They're some of your major, emissions factors. And there are things which farmers are continually doing around enhancing productivity on farm. And we are starting to look at some of those feed supplements, but we're a fair way off still yet. And then if we think about up or down the agribusiness supply chain or food supply chain, if we look at either intensive animal production or food processing, a lot of the emissions of those sort of businesses are based off energy costs and their electricity usage. And in South Australia, we're really fortunate to have a very high proportion of renewables in our system, so that puts us in a strong position. But meeting those extra few percent around the edges, for some businesses, it's viable and they are looking to do what they can in that space. For many other businesses, we still haven't got the technology in a commercially applicable way for them to implement in their business here and today.
My guest is Dave McEwen. He's the head of sustainable agriculture at Thomas Elder. So there's still obviously, as you say, a lot of work to do. There is a lot of work ongoing, whether it's on individual farms or from an industry perspective. But what is driving it all at the moment, Dave? Is it government policy? Is it market demand? Is it a social license? Is it farmers desiring this? Is it a bit of all of the above?
I think you've covered off the fairly broad gamut there. We really are seeing it from the investment community. That is really driving, right through from large listed companies such as Elders and our investment community around what they see as important and, what they require to make an investment in us, right through to we're starting to see, and we'll see it accelerate very quickly for finance in through the banking sector, which is going to impact family farms every day of the week in the next coming years. So we are seeing that come very quickly through from the finance and banking sector, that investment sector. We are starting to see it from a regulatory perspective, both at an international perspective with the setting of global targets, and then that cascades down through federally based targets and state based targets all the way through to, so we're starting to see some of those regulatory drivers sitting within there, and some of that will cause positive change, but there's a whole lot of perverse outcomes if we get that wrong. So things like reduction in fertiliser use, which we're starting to see in other countries to drive some of these net zero ambitions, those things have a really poor outcome for agricultural productions, but also, in essence, actually, the emissions intensity of the crops as well, and actually a less productive and less efficient crops. So we're seeing the regulatory piece, then right through to absolutely, we're starting to see that broader societal change and that broader consumer trust and confidence about what we need. We're seeing that. And then right through to our global markets as well. So, our domestic customers, we're starting to see it. But globally, more and more, we're getting that demand from our global customers. Some of them are paying a very small premium at the moment for farmers and agribusiness supply chains to demonstrate that they've got a low emissions base. But over time, we would expect that will probably become a norm for many of our international markets.
Dave McEwen there. He is the head of Thomas Elder Sustainable Agriculture, and he was on that panel yesterday at the Regional Australia Institute event. It's 19 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, foreign investment in Australian agriculture, it's always a hot topic. Well, most recently, a Canadian pension company spent $180 million to take a majority share in Ellerslie Free Range Farms, which owns 50% of Sunny Queen, one of the country's biggest egg producers. Meanwhile, a bidding war for Namoi Cotton, Australia's largest cotton ginning company, could be on the cards. $122 million takeover bid been put in from a Singaporean company. Rural economist Ben Lyon says it's an indicator of how world markets view Australian agriculture.
It sort of points to how well placed Australian agriculture is going forward over the next few decades. And these are very long-term investors. So they take a longer-term view. And that long-term view is sort of reinforcing the confidence they have in Australia to produce a quality, high-quality product. That Olam, you know, is and Louis Dreyfus have been active in Australia for a number of years now. They, you know, invested in Queensland cotton back in 2007.
Why don't you think there's a lot of interest from Australian companies to try and put bids in this regards?
The only investors that could potentially compete with these type of fairly significant investments are either sort of banks or superannuation funds, and superannuation funds have traditionally shied away from it. There's also some risk. Australia agriculture deals with the most, you know, one of the most variable climates in the world, and we're also subject to a lot of volatility in our markets. We've also got an exchange rate because we export 70 to 75% of what we produce in agriculture. We're also exposed to Australian dollar fluctuations, which at the moment are, you know, quite good with a low dollar. That makes our exports quite competitive. Basically, we don't have the depth of an investment market, so we just don't have as, you know, as many people with as deep a pocket.
Some people could be concerned that we're losing a little bit of our sovereignty there by having overseas interests purchase very critical infrastructure in the food and fibre areas in Australia. Should people be concerned?
I don't think people should be concerned. I think the industry would take some pride in that you know, there is a track record of, you know, foreign investment has been around for a long time in Australian agriculture. So we're quite used to that ownership model. I'd suggest that in terms of overall trends of corporatisation, there's probably just been a natural progression, you know, coming out of the post-war era where we had a lot of federal investment in populating the interior. And a lot of those farming lots weren't viable in the long term. So there's been a collation or a aggregation of those to make them into more, you know, have better scales of economy. I'd suggest that the rise of the family corporate probably is a bigger trend to look at. So that's families that are getting more to a corporate size, and there's a growing number of those in Australian agriculture. What we're talking about with Sunny Queen Eggs is an example of a family corporate that's been highly successful, and this is just another stage of their progression of their history, moving into, you know, moving away or selling part of their business to an overseas investor. The downsides of that we often research, you know, there's a you know, obviously concerns or obvious concerns around these family owned sort of corporations or family farms are obviously big parts of their local community. So they have a big loyalty and provide a lot in terms of employment, but also other benefits and, you know, social infrastructure to their rural communities that they're located in. And that's often can be viewed as a problem from a foreign, and, you know, with more foreign investment, there's less of that engagement or less of that sort of alignment in values. But I'd suggest that that's sort of tempered by any influx of capital's very useful to any enterprise, and often will lead to higher levels of productivity. You can have potentially better jobs, better, you know, more highly paid employees. It's not necessarily the case always that you have a more efficient organisation, maybe because of that lack of understanding of how to, you know, the day-to-day running of these operations. The government would probably be concerned from a productivity point of view, you know, how good are they at managing these assets? Can they improve them as operations? Can they create more value in these investments? So that would be the bigger question. I don't think we're overly dominated by foreign investment as yet, but it is something we're very mindful of. And I know that we've had a lot of very parochial concerns around Chinese investment, for example, in agricultural assets. But I think some of our restrictions could be viewed by many, particularly those in the investment game, as overbearing. But then some would say they're not. You know, there needs to be some government regulation and intervention at times. But overall, we have a pretty open and free and fairly stable agricultural investment market.
As Ben Lyon speaking there, he's from the University of Southern Queensland, their Rural Economics Centre of Excellence, and he was speaking to Brandon Long. It's almost 25 minutes past 12. You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour today. Let's head off to the Weather Bureau. No market reports this week, no regular market reports because there are none due to the Easter long weekend. Mark Analuck is our forecaster today at the Bureau. Afternoon, Mark.
Good afternoon, Selena.
How's the weather looking at the moment?
Well, it looks pretty good across the state, really. Yesterday's rainfall in the far northwest produced about 9 millimetres at Pukacha Ernabella, 0.6 millimetres at Tyon in the far, far north of the state. That's all sort of dissipated now, and we're just seeing little bits of high-level cloud drifting across northern parts of the state. A little bit of onshore cloud over the southern coastal fringes, but if I was to summarise the weather across South Australia in two words, I would say mostly sunny. Those conditions will continue into tomorrow under the influence of a pretty strong high-pressure system that's sort of trying to drift eastwards, south of us. And as that high-pressure system moves into the Tasman Sea on Friday, we'll see those winds start to shift east-northeasterly, and temperatures will rise across the state by a degree or two each day for tomorrow and then on Friday. As that high moves into the Tasman, we'll see a deepening trough over central Australia, and that'll help to produce some shower and thunderstorm activity across the northern parts of South Australia on Friday. It'll start on Friday, probably start in the far northwest and northeast corners. On Saturday, it'll come together over sort of through central parts of the state and gradually extend southwards over the pastoral and Flinders districts, possibly reaching northern agricultural areas later on Saturday. And then on Sunday, we'll see it pretty much sort of turn into a bit of a band of rain as it moves southeastwards, weakens, and continues to move eastwards through Monday and into Tuesday before another high pressure system moves in south of the Bight early next week, producing cooler southerly winds for agricultural areas. For the Easter weekend, agricultural areas can expect mostly dry conditions through Friday, Saturday, but we'll see some of that moisture move down from the north during Sunday, Monday. So it could be a sort of, particularly for central and eastern districts on Sunday and Monday. Rainfall amounts, again, still pretty hard to give exact numbers depending on where you are. But for the most part, we're talking about less than a couple of millimetres about southern coasts, but highly variable falls of up to 30 millimetres across the pastoral and Flinders districts. And there is a risk we'll see higher totals with some heavy thunderstorms leading to flash flooding through the northeast pastoral and northern Flinders ranges through Sunday and Monday. So we could probably see a sort of 30 to 60 millimetres at this stage. But again, there's a fair bit of uncertainty with what's happening Sunday, Monday. So please keep an eye on the forecasts, and we'll give you another update again tomorrow. Hopefully things will be a little bit more obvious. But at this stage, that's the general pattern, what we're expecting, Selena. Mm-hmm. And hopefully Simon will have more information for you tomorrow.
All right, yeah, it could be a very interesting end to the long weekend for some. Mark, thanks for that.
My pleasure.
Mark Analuck from the Weather Bureau. Now, looking at the forecast for the western inland parts of New South Wales, I should say. For tomorrow, the upper western district looking at a sunny day with southeasterly winds, 15 to 25 k's an hour. They'll tend east to southeasterly around 20 to 30 k's an hour in the morning, tending south to southeasterly, 15 to 25 k's an hour in the evening. Overnight temperatures down to between 15 and 18 degrees. Daytime temps in the low to mid 30s. For the lower western district tomorrow, also sunny with south to southeasterly winds, 15 to 25 k's an hour, becoming light in the evening. Overnight temperatures falling to around 12, and during the day they'll climb up to around 30 degrees. It is coming up to half past 12 here on the South Australian Country Hour. In this next half an hour, I'm going to cross to Wilcannia. There's been a meeting this morning, some concerns around what's happening with the weir there, so I'll bring you a full update. Also, the winner of the South Australian AgriFutures Rural Women's Award has been announced, and we'll find out who the winner is and have a chat to her in this next half an hour.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Good afternoon. Now, we've heard a lot about how country towns are struggling to attract skilled workers, and a lot of that is down to a lack of suitable and affordable housing. So could mining-style villages, could they be the answer? I'll take a look at that shortly. Also, have you ever had an animal give birth to a big litter? What's the largest litter you've ever seen? I'd like to hear about that today. What kind of numbers are we talking here? 1300 222 891, or the text line at 0467 922 891, because you're going to meet a South Australian farmer who was very surprised by the arrival of sextuplets from one of his sheep.
Yeah, the mother, as you can imagine, was quite exhausted. She was laying on the ground for most of yesterday, but we've been tending to her and she's come back quite well now.
Good to hear, but yeah, gosh, don't blame her for having a good lie down after that. You'll hear that story and more, and this is all to come after news headlines from Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, SA Health's chief executive has acknowledged that elective surgery delays will be disappointing for patients and says the department did not make the decision lightly. Category 2 and 3 elective surgeries at Adelaide's hospitals have been postponed from today until midnight on Thursday. Robin Lawrence says the last-minute decision was in response to concerns about demand over Easter and that surgeries will resume as usual after the long weekend. Police are investigating the deaths of three people who were on a fishing boat that overturned after being hit by a wave near Port Lincoln on Monday. They are among a crew of five who are believed to be close family and friends. Searchers rescued a 13-year-old boy and a 44-year-old man sheltering on a reef early yesterday. And the AFL's Gather Round returns to the Adelaide Hills next weekend for its second year with a new free two-day community event in Harndorf. The festivities will coincide with back-to-back sold-out matches in Mount Barker on Saturday and Sunday next week. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, residents living along the Darling River in New South Wales say they've been blindsided by the state government's decision to change the plans for the proposed rebuild of Wilcannia's weir. After several years of extensive community consultation up until 2022, preceded by decades of lobbying, a design was agreed on by the locals. Now changes have been made due to what Labor says are budget constraints. But many, like Tilpa resident and chair of the Australia Floodplain Association, Justin McClure, strongly disagree, saying that proposed changes are substandard and will impact the town's drought reserve.
The Department of Water, our infrastructure, are heading back to Wilcannia today, I think, to try and sell the substandard design they've bullied upon us, to try and convince the community that this is a good outcome for the community. Community are pretty staunch in their support of, they are 100% behind the conceptual design, which was designed in 2022. The community is united across the board, and we're going to meet with the department and keep putting up our case politely that they need to build the weir as consulted upon in 2022.
Why do you say substandard?
Substandard, they propose to build a structure which is a metre lower than the conceptual design, will not have a gated structure, which will give us the ability to release poor quality water downstream when a good flow is coming. By lowering the weir by a metre, it's going to the reserve for the town of Wilcannia, halve the amount of water that the town will have to survive, basically.
And you also mentioned bullied into the decision. Do you want to just elaborate on that a bit as well?
Yeah, look, look, I think, bully's the right word. The community were consulted with from 2019 through to 22 when the design was decided. Basically, we've had a flood in between. There's been no consultation in the meantime. With stealth, the department came back to Wilcannia in December with very, very poor advertising and let nobody know they were coming, to the extent that only one person showed up, and he only fell over the advertisement in a local paper. Well, that completely changed the design of what was proposed. So now they're back in force. This is their second trip. They consulted with us a month ago. The Shire were very, very strong in rejecting the amended design out of hand, and the local community rejected that design 100%. So the community itself has been completely hijacked. They've been blindsided by this decision. They're not very, very happy. When you look at the reality, over the last 50 years, there's been an 80% decrease in the low flows of Wilcannia, Now, this lack of flow was now going to be held up by new weir, and it's given life, it's given oxygen to the community of Wilcannia. It's given them a goal to strive for. It's given them a reason to improve. Well, it's going to improve Wilcannia out of sight, and it's given the community a lot more confidence to march forward. So we've been absolutely robbed of the opportunity to partake in a normal life like other upstream communities do.
How would you describe the consultation process here compared to the previous consultation process?
This is not a consultation process. This has been a hijack. There has been no consultation. It has been very, very poor.
Are there any other issues with the new weir as well that you'd like to mention?
Look,
the new design of the weir, sorry?
Four or five reasons why they've gone back to a substandard design. One of them is cost, and we've got a pretty strong argument is that if you're going to take something away from a community such as Wilcannia, which is a disadvantaged community, and what we were going to get was another metre in our weir pool, which would have given us a brighter outlook for the future. So to suggest that cost, that you can take something away from a community which has been promised something and then take it away is very, very unjust. To spend $70 million at Terrell up the river with no community benefit, and to deny Wilcannia that same sort of investment is a total injustice. That's point one. The EIS has been, they identified issues of drownout in the weir. If you look at drownout in the weir, the 80% of the flows that have been taken away from the Wilcannia community, that river used to run 85% of the time. Now it runs nearly less than 15% of the time. All we are recreating by putting a weir structure and a gated weir structure in that river is giving back what has been taken, what has been ripped out of our community over the last 60 years.
For a project that's been promised for decades, as you said, 40, 50 years there, I imagine not just yourself but quite a few others in the community are feeling pretty down about it, just from what you've said here?
Bill, there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of anger that the government can step into this space and just rip something away with no consultation.
That is the chair of the Australia Floodplain Association, Justin McClure, and he was speaking there to Bill Ormond. Well, there was a meeting actually held in Wilcannia this morning to discuss these concerns, and our Broken Hill reporter, Lily McClure, was there. Lily, thanks for joining us on the program.
Hey, Selena.
So give us an idea of what the feeling was like in the room this morning.
Well, as you just heard from Justin, it's everyone's pretty angry about it. There was a room of about 40 in the community hall in Wilcannia, and there was a lot of anger and a lot of questions that people in the community had about this new weir design.
We've heard some of the concerns, but what has been the response from the government?
So they've said that this new weir design needed to be, I guess, designed because he claimed that the original design didn't fit the environmental impact statement and that process and requirements. Things like due to the disturbance of cultural heritage sites and the interruptions to biodiversity as well as cost. But the community have said, you know, this new plan does not address any of their concerns and their needs, and they're still really worried about the health of the river and the water and its wildlife.
So where to from here for the community?
So they have expressed their concerns. It was, as I said, a lot of questions in there and a lot of anger. And it was met with answers like they're going to take it back, take their concerns. This is still, it's still in consultation. Nothing's been locked in terms of the design. But they've just said, we need to get more people out here. We need someone like Minister Rose Jackson, for Minister for Water, to come out here and really see what's going on and their anger.
Lily, thanks for crossing into the program.
No problem. Thanks, Lena.
That's our Broken Hill-based reporter, Lily McCure, reporting there live from Wilcannia. There was a meeting held there this morning. I understand that there is another one being held this afternoon in the community hall, being hosted by the New South Wales Department of Climate Change, Energy, Environment and Water. You're going to hear more about this from locals on tomorrow's Country Hour as well. Right now, it's 20 minutes to one.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, a housing shortage in regional areas is posing a massive challenge for employers. So one solution could be mining-style villages. Well, major meat processor Thomas Foods International says it's one possible way to meet the housing needs for agricultural workers here in South Australia. Its general manager, Tom Davies, says in time, more than 1,000 workers at the Murray Bridge abattoir will need accommodation. But housing availability and affordability, as we've heard, are big barriers preventing the growth of regional communities. Well, Mr. Davies spoke with Caroline Horn, and said the large agricultural employer is exploring mining-style villages to house its workers.
That is something that's on the cards. We've looked at a number of different proposals from, I guess, looking both in different states and also up in sort of that northern South Australia at Olympic Dam as to kind of what that, really I call it village-style camp to house multiple workers. So we've looked at a lot of different designs and examples, and then it comes down to land release.
And also things like rent-to-buy. What would that sort of involve?
So a rent-to-buy model is where, obviously, from an investment perspective, that it comes in from sort of that corporate side of the investment cycle. And then as the renter rents their house, eventually at a point in time, they get that opportunity to buy the house on a much more affordable terms.
So Thomas and Natasha would build the house, the workers would rent and buy. Is that what you were thinking?
It'd probably look at a co-partnering model. So obviously Thomas Foods would look to partner with someone to develop the proposal and the project, and then we'd look at housing our workers and for giving them that opportunity to buy into the market.
And then from your point of view as well, that also gives, you know, that economy of scale and, yeah, being able to think, well, we've got that market there, we can, you know, go and find a partner and say, look, we've got these people, well, you know, potentially these people.
Yeah, it's about finding the right scale because, obviously, as you know, we've got a lot of workers already in the country, a lot of workers to come in to the country, or even from a domestic perspective, considering the cost of living and the challenge for anyone to afford a house these days. So we're looking at a multitude of models, and rent to buy is just one of them.
Because Murray Bridge is what I think you said, less than 0.5% vacancy rate.
Yeah, so that's a tight market for us at the moment. Obviously, we've just finalised the commissioning about sort of 6 to 12 months ago of that facility, and it's up and running. But that's still got a lot of growth in it, and a stage two development as well. So, in due course, that's going to have over 1,000 workers. So they're all going to require somewhere to stay.
As Thomas Foods International General Manager Tom Davies, he was speaking there to Caroline Horn at a Regional Australia Institute event in Adelaide. He was one of the panellists on that day. It's 17 minutes to one.
Hey, want to hear something really funny?
Well, of course.
The Melbourne International Comedy Festival is back.
Woohoo!
Yes.
Kicking off with the gala on the ABC tonight.
You ready for a big night of comedy, yeah?
Then the All-Stars Super Show next Wednesday night.
Things can be a little bit loose, a little bit crazy.
A brilliant star lineup for the Melbourne International Comedy Festival.
Have a great festival, everybody.
Starting with the gala tonight on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
Well, South Australia has named its AgriFutures Rural Women Award winner, and drumroll, it's Nikki Atkinson from the Flinders Ranges. And Nikki is the founder and designer of Horrocks Vale Collections, which creates wedding dresses and special occasion wear from sustainable merino wool. The awards ceremony was held in Adelaide last night. Nikki Atkinson, hello, welcome to the Country Hour, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. I am just
overwhelmed and extremely excited.
I know these things are always a shock when it's your name that gets called out. Have you sort of wrapped your head around the fact that you're the winner so far?
I think so. After the countless messages and thank yous and everything, I think I've wrapped my head around it, and now thinking about the next stage and onto the next big stage, which will be Canberra later this year.
Fantastic. And we'll talk in a minute a bit about, I guess, the opportunity that you see coming from being named the winner. But just remind us a bit about your story and your business that you came to create and how you came to be in this field of making wedding dresses for merino wool.
So I've been in the industry for over 25 years, in the wedding dress couture industry for over 25 years, but always have wanted to be able to create wedding dresses out of wool. So a girlfriend of mine got married 21 years ago, couldn't find the wool for love nor money back then when I had my bridal boutique. I married my farmer, Dallas. He dragged me away from the bright lights of the city back to my country roots. And so that moment never left me. I've always been on the search for the perfect fibre. And it's uncanny because I'm actually combining my two loves and my advocacy for Australian merino wool, now that I live on a grazing merino wool property, but also creating beautiful designs. So that's how it started.
What a wonderful opportunity to, as you say, marry those two passions of yours. What is it about merino wool, and particularly for the use in fashion and for wedding dresses in particular, that makes it such a wonderful material to work with?
It's just a luxury fibre that's completely undersold, and I've always known that in the wedding space it would be perfect, because when you see my wedding dresses on the catwalk or a photograph of the dresses, people have no idea that they're actually out of wool. And the wonderful thing about wool is that if you're wearing a wool wedding dress on a 40-degree day, you're not going to have sweat dripping down your back. It's actually temperature controlling, so it's going to take the heat away, unlike polyester dresses. And also the reverse, if it's cold, so it keeps the heat in. So it's actually, it looks amazing, it feels amazing, but it's also hypoallergenic and fantastic to wear against the body.
Of course, wool's been around forever. Australian wool industry has, you know, been here for hundreds of years, and it's not a new fabric. But is that the story that you have to keep, you know, is that still something that we still have to keep selling to consumers, this knowledge and understanding of what makes wool so good to work with?
Absolutely. Even though I've been a couturier for over 25 years, I feel like I'm starting my business again, because I'm having to educate people, because people still think it's scratchy, itchy. They still think, oh, wool's fantastic for winter, but it's actually those myths that I'm here to bust, and in a different space that has never been done before. So it's very innovative. But yes, I feel like I'm starting again and, you know, educating people about wool.
I know that France, for example, recently they passed a bill to penalise fast fashion, is something we've seen certainly take off in recent years, a lot of really fast fashion, cheap materials that just ends up in landfill. You hoping that there is a bit of a mind shift around using more sustainable materials, more slow fashion, and wool is perfect for this?
Absolutely. And this is what's going to happen. So I feel like I'm at the forefront of sustainability in the wedding space, because majority of dresses are actually polyester and fossil fuel. So fast fashion is something that's going to have to change, because it is the biggest contributor to landfill. And people don't know that. They don't understand that, because they'll just order a dress online that's really cheap and easy, which is, you know, that's another conversation for another day. But yes, those fashion houses are actually going to have to change. And I think the consumers are actually going to need to think about, do they actually really need that particular item for $50 if they can't send it back, or it's going to cost $50 to send back? Like, have a think, do they really need it? And what's wrong with wearing something again? So yes, the whole landfill thing is just a conversation that the fashion industry are going to have to embrace and do something about completely.
Now, you receive some grants and some professional development opportunities as part of your win. How do you intend to use those to grow your business and, you know, grow this story about merino wool?
I'm wanting to use this money to be able to employ a PR company that can help Hurricane Collections and my brand to the next level it deserves to be. putting Horrocksville collections in front of the right eyes, but also I'm currently looking for wholesalers because I want to wholesale my range that I currently have. So that will help me leverage the business and also look for influencers, because fashion is all about influencers and the right influencers. And I also intend to take Horrocksville collections over the seas to Harrogate in England, to one of the biggest bridal fairs, which is a wholesale bridal fair in England, and be able to show my wares and wear the woolly flag with absolute passion and showcase these dresses to the international waters.
You wave that flag proudly, Nikki. Congratulations again, and we look forward to following your journey, as you say, through to the Nationals in Canberra later this year. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for your time.
As the South Australian winner of the 2024 AgriFutures Rural Women's Award, Nikki Atkinson, so not just waving, but wearing the woolly flag. Congratulations also to the other two finalists who were in the running for that award announced last night, Susie Evans from Mantung and Susie Williams from Wollonga. So as the state winner, Nikki receives a $15,000 grant and some professional development opportunities. And as we said, she's in the running for the national award. That'll be announced at an event in Canberra later in the year. There's another $20,000 grant, I should say, up for grabs. Now, as I mentioned when I was speaking to Nikki Atkinson there, France's lower house of parliament has recently approved a bill unanimously that would impose penalties on ultra-fast fashion products. This bill calls for increasing penalties of up to 10 euros per item of clothing by 2030, along with a ban on advertising for such products. French lawmakers say fast fashion is driving pollution and the bill's aimed at reducing the industry's environmental impact. The district wool manager for Elders in Victoria, Maddie Gallagher, told Fiona Broom that fast fashion bill presents an opportunity for the natural fibre industries.
Last week, French lawmakers, they passed an interesting bill voting in favour of penalties being applied to cheaply made fast fashion and even banning the advertising of these products. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out over the next few weeks as that bill goes to Senate.
What would be considered fast fashion? Is that something that is made quickly, made perhaps out of synthetic fibres?
That's exactly right. So it's looking at those mass producers and people producing like mainly polyester clothing, which is ending up in our landfills. So it's hugely an environmental bill. But the good news is for wool producers, it's promoting the use of those renewable fibres, which is something that we really need to play off as wool producers, because we have a very unique product in today's environmental and regenerative environment.
Do we sell a lot of Australian wool into the European market?
Most goes through to China, but we do sell a portion to the European market. The big thing about this bill, though, is it is going to target those companies producing mass cheap polyester goods out of China. So it will affect production globally.
That is the wool manager for Elders Eastern Victoria, Maddie Gallagher, and she was speaking there to Fiona Broom.
Time for the family road trip.
98.
The big prawn.
Ah, yes.
99.
The big mosquito.
It's a real one.
And 100.
Easy.
The big listen app.
Of course.
The ABC Listen app has a big array of road trip ready podcasts, radio, audiobooks, music and sport. Something for everyone.
I guess it has to be big to fit in all those podcasts.
Aww. For a big selection of audio entertainment,
really,
listen big. Download the free ABC Listen app today.
That could come in very handy if you're planning a Easter long weekend road trip. Something to keep everyone entertained in the car. You're with Selena Green. It is just going on 7 minutes to 1. Well, I'm sure you've heard of plenty of ewes having twins or triplets, but have you ever heard of an Aussie lamb having sextuplets? Well, one crossbred Merino ewe this week gave birth to 6 lambs at Corinn in the southeast of the state. And hobby farmer Brad Shepherd says it was a very unexpected delivery.
Basically walked out to go to work yesterday morning, and my partner came in and said, "Oh, we've got lambs. We've been waiting. The lambs, the ewes are all about due." She comes in and said, "Yeah, we've got lambs." And I walked out, and obviously to my shock, walked out and saw 6 of them sprawled out across the ground. Unfortunately, one died at birth, but the other 5 are all doing quite well at the moment. So,
yeah, so you're fairly certain they definitely came from the one ewe?
Yeah, 100%. I went round straight away and checked the other ewes. None of them had sunken hips. They're all quite still, obviously quite full. And yeah, the mother, as you can imagine, was quite exhausted. She was laying on the ground for most of yesterday, but we've been tending to her and she's come back quite well now. We're currently putting the two lambs that we have left with us are back on her to give them the best chance, but the other three are with the lamb rescue at the moment, so we just sort of a little bit too much for us to take on all at once.
Have you ever had anything close to six lambs from one ewe before?
Oh, never, never. I'm, you know, not much of a farmer, a bit of a hobby farmer, as I said, but yeah, never. I have had sheep in the past and never had anything like this, and still quite shocked, to be honest. Yeah, it's not something you see every day, so it's quite special.
So, yeah, logistics-wise, is there anything special you need to do now with the lambs that are there? Will the ewe be fine taking care of those two?
Well, basically, we're just very, very lucky. We have people around our area, like Rebecca and Joe and whatnot, that do have the lamb rescue. So if it wasn't for the lamb rescue, it would have been a, you know, a lot of tending to the lambs and, you know, things like not getting colostrum and that on their first day is always a bad thing. So they've sorted those ones out, given them the colostrum and all the rest. And for us, it's basically trying to get the two that we've kept with us back onto the mother, as she obviously can't deal with six. Two's probably the limit. So, yeah, she's basically just trying to get her back with the lambs and see if she'll take them back on.
And, yeah, well, I guess what's the fate of the ewe now? Are you going to be breeding her again, seeing if she has another six in her?
Probably not. We're not here to breed, not here to try and make money or try and break any records or anything, just more so just for the kids to have a bit of that experience. I grew up on a bit of a farm and had that sort of upbringing and sort of thought it would be nice for our kids to have the same. And so, yeah, look, she'll probably, honestly, probably be retired and just go out into the paddock and live out her life, you know, with her hay and her feed and just enjoying it, I think. She needs a bit of a break after that.
Hobby farmer Brad Shepherd. So, just how rare is it for one ewe to birth six lambs? Well, according to veterinarian Dr. Amelia Reid with the Millicent and Kingston Vet Clinic, it's a very unusual occurrence.
To have six lambs is extremely rare. Normally, having triplets is quite common, but anything over that is an amazing feat, really, for that ewe. Incredible.
One in 100,000, one in a million. What kind of odds are we talking here, do you think?
Oh, we'd have to, I don't know off the top of my head, but we'd have to be talking over one in a thousand at least. However, I've never seen it actually occur in the area nor where I've previously worked before. So very, very rare.
I think the smallest lamb weighed in at 1.3 kilograms. Is that pretty small for a lamb?
No, that's not too bad. It is small, but that would be expected given the amount she's had and the ewes had to feed lots of those lambs in her belly for quite some time now. So that's actually quite a good weight considering the number that she gave birth to.
And would there be any long-term health impacts, would you think, for the ewe?
No, not really. Really, she's just going to need to have some good nutrition and a lot of love and a lot of care to pull her through raising the lambs that she has on her.
And the same goes for the surviving lambs? There won't be any long-term health impacts on the way they were born?
No, they shouldn't do, as long as they get lots of colostrum in that first 24 hours, which sounds like they have, and they have a nice steady plane of nutrition, they should be absolutely fine and go on to live a happy life.
Is there anything that leads to ewes having so many lambs, or is it just really luck of the draw?
Really, it's just luck of the draw. It's sometimes we just see this and, yeah, lucky girl and a surprise for the farmer, that's for sure.
Lucky girl, but yeah, she definitely deserves to go out into the paddock now and enjoy a break. That's veterinarian Dr. Amelia Reid speaking with Elsie Adamo. And hop on abc.net.au/rural to see some cute pics, including some of the lambs in their cute little knitted jumpers. That's almost it for me for today. I'll be handing over to this man. He'll be on your radio very soon, Nikolai Bell-Hartz with Afternoons. Hello.
No.
I know. They're so cute. They're little knitted. Anything in a little knitted jumper is cute, let's be honest.
It's a kind of an automatic qualification, isn't it?
It is, exactly. Well,
hopefully they're not going to be getting too hot in those jumpers because we're going to be speaking about the heat this afternoon. And while it's not as hot as it has been in recent times in SA, the often contentious issue of the colour of your roof has come up again. It does seem to be the thing with a lot of new builds, particularly that you have really dark coloured roofs.
Yeah, it's quite trendy at the moment.
Yeah, so like, is it just a trend, or is there a kind of a broader reason behind it? Because some new research has been done that looks at how much it can actually cost you to have a roof that is a dark colour, because it absorbs the heat, and then you have to spend more money to cool the house. So we'll be taking a look at that this afternoon, and we'll also be looking at life skills, really, the things that maybe we learnt a little bit more in previous generations, you know, how to change a tyre, how to balance a budget, some of those
skills.
Sew
a button.
Yes,
still
a button.
Can't do that.
I know. Some of them are hard. But there's a council in Adelaide is offering how to adult classes for people that are 15 to 25 who maybe feel like they don't have some of those skills. So we're going to take a look at whether or not those skills have been lost or they're not being taught. Does the internet play a role in all this? I'll be taking a look at that too.
I like that. How to adult. There are some days when I do it does. If I might need a little help with that. Yeah. Thanks, Nikolai. Have a great show. Nikolai Valhartz will be with you this afternoon with those stories and much, much more. Thanks so much for your company. You can find more online, abc.net.au/rural, or look up the South Australian Country Hour. It's news time.
Can't remember the talkback number? Download the ABC Listen app and tap your local ABC radio station to call or message us direct from the app. Join the conversation.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.